As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. In charge of discrete at CFRA is Kenneth Leon. Ken Leon's been doing this for years, and we're going to not only look at Morgan Stanley, but with Ken Leon, look across all of banking. Are the days over, Ken Leon, where they announce a 6% layoff? Or is everybody cuter about it now, 20 here, 10 here in Asia, et cetera?
Well, Tom, it's good to be with you. And, you know, these businesses are cyclical, so we can always see that as a scenario. But the narrative is not about going into recession, significant layoffs, or streamlining. It's about taking advantage of technology, and most importantly today, with disappointing Bank of America results and probably very strong Morgan Stanley results, it's the capital markets that's going to give you outperformance.
I look at the capital markets, and to me, what's important here is on an employee basis, there may be layoffs, but they're going to rehire the same amount of people or more in other areas like technology and intellectual content. Is that what's happening?
It is. And even on one of the calls yesterday, they're talking about artificial intelligence or AI and how you can work that into processes of the bank, particularly the back office.
Sector dispersion is usually at its highest during peak periods of market distress, Ken. I'm curious, you know, it's been abnormally high in U.S. equity since the pandemic. Talk to us a little bit about the role of sector allocation, diversification in the current environment.
It's a good question. And as a research director and looking top down, I'm thinking of the financial sector for listeners. There are 12 constituents. Berkshire Hathaway is the largest. The six largest banks are in there. They're 65% of the sector. So we're going to have a full week of bank earnings. But quite frankly, for your question, the most important one is the performance and outlook of the six largest global U.S. banks.
Interesting. So, you know, rate-sensitive sectors, other rate-sensitive sectors, sorry, like utilities and real estate, are probably the two worst performing sectors in the S&P this year, I believe. Talk to us about those sectors. Do they stand out to you in the current environment?
Yeah, we have an underweight on those sectors, mostly because, we have the scenario of a very healthy economy.
Yeah.
And we think that looking out, even if we have a correction, and Sam Stolva, our chief investment strategist, there's been 24 corrections since World War II, but they come back to regain those losses in 4 months. That's the average. So we'd like to be with growth, which is technology. We also like communication services and also consumer discretionary.
I look, Ken Leon, with the Morgan Stanley earnings, and I guess it comes down to the strategic difference, the distinction between Goldman Sachs with a bang-up effort the other day, maybe awful lot of gloom about David Solomon. Boy, he pushed that aside. In Morgan Stanley here, what's the distinction between Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and what does Mr. Pick show this morning?
Well, there's two things. First of all, what is the body language and really delivery of a new CEO versus one of the Hall of Fame, James Gorman? Second, I think, Tom, we're entering a very interesting period. I said capital markets is really going to drive these particular firms. But when you look at Goldman Sachs and asset management, it's their really closer link to alternative investments, private equity, and equity and debt financing. There is $1 trillion right. of business from sponsors still to be released into the market that will benefit Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
What do you think about this, Damien? What's your distinction right now between Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley?
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing is, well, they're two very different banks right now.
But I agree with that. That's important.
And I think really for me, I'm looking at credit card delinquencies above pre-COVID levels, bankruptcies rising, housing activity in decline. So I take a little bit of your point, Ken, with the fact that this economy is completely healthy. I mean, talk to me about these recession odds. I mean, they've fallen substantially. Can the Fed really, truly engineer a soft landing?
I think Jay Powell's getting better in his messaging. He needs to be more Alan Greenspan, because when things are quite honestly working well, that, you know, and I keep hearing from the financial media, rates higher, you know, even at these levels, corporates are beginning to go to the capital market. The first quarter was a record for debt underwriting since 1980. And I think for the consumer, there are parts of the population that do suffer, but I think we're going to wait. There's no need to cut rates immediately.
You know, one of the things that's important here, folks, is we await the Ken Leon 62-page annual letter. It's like James Diamond's letter. It's just right. Ken Leon. Ken Leon, what would you put in your 62-page letter after seeing these bank earnings, their reports on revenue, Moynihan's effort on digital? What do they look like 5 years out?
Wow. It's a great question, and I think what we'll see is that these banks are positioned to flourish and grow as we see innovation and change in the market.
You know, you asked me a little bit earlier about what the difference between those banks are. And the way I see it is, you know, net interest income versus wealth management. I mean, to some extent, right? And I'm talking B of A to Morgan Stanley.
A bank versus asset management.
A very big bank, yeah. though. And so my question for you, Ken, is talk to me about this curve. I mean, everyone seems to think the curve's going to steepen. That should be pretty, pretty bullish for Bank of America, for Citigroup, for JPM, no?
Well, Bank of America probably went 0 for 10 on the results today, but on net interest
income. Okay, we got to stop the show here. This is the second time you've mentioned this. Where did Moynihan fail today?
They missed it on net interest income. They missed it on wealth management. They missed it on investment banking. And on trading, it was just average compared to even JP Morgan Chase or Citi. So, but to that question, net interest income, they're getting pressure on cost of deposits. I went through the 60-page supplemental, and I'm just not finding anything to cheer about. And believe me, I look at
right.
all the key metrics.
Oh, come on. The solution, Ken Leon, is they got 212,000 people. They're going to go in there after they hear the Ken Leon report. How many bodies does it take to right-size Bank of America after a challenge?
You know, in history for Bank of America, and I've been covering them 15 years, you do sometimes get quarters like that, and then they come back strongly next quarter. But they are one of the best in terms of their disclosure and explaining their performance.
Ken, not even equity trading? I thought equity trading beat.
It's very minor. It's actually equity trading is a very small component.
No, I'm joking. I'm looking for one silver lining in the report. I agree with you, Ken.
Yeah, Ken Leon, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate this. Wonderful to finish.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Gene at Munster now with Deepwater Asset Management. Gene, thank you so much for joining us and to talk on Apple today. They got a May 2nd earnings report. I want to forget about all the gloom about China, revenue worries and that. Can they hold margins and continue to develop free cash flow, which has basically doubled since pre-pandemic? Can they still generate ample free cash flow growth?
The simple answer is yes, they can. They generate about $100 billion in operating income. And so this is about a $350, $400 billion revenue company. They'll probably do about $95 billion this year. Free cash flow will be around $55 billion. So this is still right. A machine when it comes to, and I want to, I think I buried the lead relative to that data point about their free cash flow, is revenue growth. If you take what it will be in the March quarter, what they're going to report in a few weeks here, revenue growth over the past eight quarters has been down, will be down 0.4% on average. So they continue to drive that kind of $50 billion plus free cash flow despite revenue right. being flat. I think it speaks to the strength of the business model that they have.
So I got to go back to use of cash and running a company for profit, not growth, which I think most of the media doesn't understand here. Gina Martin Adams adamant we're going to see use of cash click in here. Are we going to see a use of cash bombshell from Apple?
I think that so first, this is going to be the period when they report their March quarter. They typically give guidance about what they're going to do in terms of expanding their buyback and their dividend. And I would expect an increase in the buyback and dividend somewhere around $25 billion. So we're continuing to see them expand, and that's over a multi-year period. But the bottom line is I expect to continue to see that move higher. That's coming at the same time where we're going to hear more about their investments in AI. They, of course, broke the seal last quarter after a full year of not proactively talking about AI, and now they have this event coming up in June where they're going to announce some products. But those products come at a cost, and there will be an investment cycle here. And I think Apple investors should be aware of that investment cycle. What does it mean ultimately for the business in the near term is you have these gross margins kind of right around 40%. There's probably going to be a little bit of a step back in gross margins, maybe by 50, 100 basis points, right. about 1%. But I do think that we do need to factor in what they're investing in AI when we think about the context of the capital distribution that they'll announce.
Damien, pre-pandemic gross margin 38%, now out at a modeled 44%.
You know, I mean, Gene, we're a little over a week away from April 25th when Microsoft, Google, and Amazon report after the bell. But before then, this Thursday, we're going to see earnings from Taiwan Semi. Tom's favorite book, Chip War, I mean, Chris Miller. I mean, talk to us a little bit about Intel, AMD, what does China and all that's going on with the chip war mean to those companies, and how are their stocks expected to perform?
So I think Intel, there are two different stories. They're both within the context of chips and in terms of when you look at what's happening in China, Intel has greater exposure relative to AMD from China. So I think that there is more of a headwind. Both of them are going to face the headwind. And specifically within China, some of these revised recommendations from the government puts Intel and AMD like eighth and ninth on the list of chip providers that they recommend. The top six are Chinese chip providers. So that is going to be a headwind. I think that's part of what has negatively impacted iPhone sales over the past year, is that there has been this focus towards Huawei within government employees. It's a massive base. So I think this is going to have a negative impact on Intel and AMD. In our flagship Titan fund, we own AMD. We do not own Intel. We have sold Intel, not because of this China, but because of, I think, just some of the challenges that they have had. I think there is some managerial challenges that they've had just to try to capture some of those faster chips and to build those better chips. So big picture is this. China is going to be an issue. It's going to be an issue for AMD, Intel, Apple, Tesla. All these companies are going to have to navigate this. It's going to get worse there over the next few years.
Gene, let's shift gears. Let's talk a little bit about M&A activity. Microsoft-backed Rubik is seeking up to $713 million in an IPO that just announced. Talk to us a little bit about the potential for M&A activity within the tech sector over the balance of 2024. Do you expect a lot more new issuance? I mean, what's really there? How deep is the pool?
So two pieces to that. First, in terms of the M&A side, is I don't expect much, in particular because the best companies already have valuations that are $5 billion plus. It's going to require some of the bigger companies to take action to be the acquirers there. And of course, given what's happened in the regulatory environment, I just see that less likely. Whether it's actually less likely to happen, I think there's just I think the management teams feel that this is not right. worth to invest the time in that. So I don't expect a lot of M&A activity. I do expect, not this year, but in 2025, to be the first year where we're going to see a class of AI-first companies go public.
Interesting.
And I think that what we have seen, of course, with the move relative to AI, a lot of that value has been created with the mega caps, but we haven't seen really an AI IPO class yet, and I think we will see it. They can be from companies like Databricks. It can be obviously OpenAI, Anthropic. Some of these kind of the ordained AI companies likely will go public 2025.
Well, let me fit in this question. Does private money front run yep. that public process?
Private money does. I want to be careful about how I answer this because, yes, the goal of private investors is to invest as valuations continue to increase into the public markets. That's how venture makes money. Of course, sometimes that gets turned upside down. And venture investors, we have venture funds too. It's a different investment style. It's more of a tech visionary. We are not only tech visionaries, but we're also tech investors. I just want to make the quick point is that I think the mistake that a lot of venture makes is they just look at everything as being rosy and can oftentimes overpay. And there is a painful, look what happened with SPACs in 2022. There's a painful correction that a lot of those earlier investors. So I think that they're just as risky. Owning stuff in venture doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to go up when it goes public.
Thanks so much, Gene Munster. Really, really wonderful comments here, particularly on Apple. Gene Munster with Deepwater Asset Management. Joining us away from a longer view of economics and really on short-term paper, truly owns the high ground, Anthony Crescenzi with us of PIMCO. Tony, should I be nervous about a 5% two-year yield?
Hey, Tom. Hey, Damian. No, you should be happy. You should be pinching yourself. You should be blissful. We haven't seen these yields in quite a long time. And it's one of the reasons why many people think that the U.S. economy is faring better. There's a story on Bloomberg today about it. Interest mm-hmm. income in the United States is about $1.8 trillion today. That's up $300 billion from 2 years ago. It's $300 billion that
but we can all go out and spend. But the ambiguity is downplayed. I'm going to blame the media for this. Interest rates are
yes,
higher.
Of course.
OMG, price down, yield up. Yeah. But you know, and you've codified in all your books, including The Great Stegums, 2,000 pages, you've codified that there's an ambiguity here. Explain the ambiguity that price down, yield up can be good for our listeners.
Well, here's a statistic going back several decades. The 5 year, looking out 5 years in terms of what you're likely to get in terms of a total return, looking at the Bloomberg aggregate, which is a pretty much a compilation
of the Bloomberg aggregate.
Let me tell you what that is. By the way, on Lehman, I worked for Lehman Brothers in the 1980s in the World Trade Center, 104th floor with a view of uptown. Remarkable mm-hmm. period that
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
But so looking at the Bloomberg aggregate today, which is 40% U.S. Treasuries, 25% mortgages, 25% corporate bonds, the yield is 5.25%. Now, if you take that figure, it's that starting yield should be the return you get the next 5 years based on the 30-year history of it. The rolling return over a multi-year period should equate to what you see as a stated yield today. So 5.25%, is that good enough? For some investors, maybe not. That's why yields are rising, prices are falling, they're selling. They think yields will go higher. But I would suggest to investors that they be careful about the story now. And what I would suggest is thinking about three don'ts about what to do in terms of investing now. We're often asked about what to do. Here's what not to do.
Right.
For one, don't try to time the market. Awfully difficult to do. Secondly, sure, perhaps don't catch a falling knife, but do catch these yields while you can. These yields could slip away. And finally, don't fight the Fed. And Tom and Damon, you might think this means, well, the Federal Reserve is keeping policy tight, so it's a bad thing. But it's tough love. The more it stays tight, and it is getting tighter based on the definition of what is tight, a falling inflation rate, and it is falling, 2.8% PCE versus a 5% yield.
Right.
They were almost equal last year. Fighting the Fed today means believing the central bank will be successful in its quest to bring inflation down. It has every means of an ability to do that.
Tom, did you see Tony wink at me when he said, don't be a short-termist to actually invest for the long term? Yeah. I mean, he winked at me. I'm reading your note, Tony, and I got to say, don't fixate on the Fed's 2% objective. Focus instead on the notion of quote-unquote price
one of my favorite ideas.
Stability. That reads like the South China Morning Post, price stability. What is price stability?
Well, Jamie, so I'm really old. Tom is much younger than me, but I recall a period before 2012, and I'm going to tell you what that means, when we didn't have a 2% price objective to go on. We had to go on something else. And what was that something else? A notion that prices are stable or they're not. So it was in 2012 that Ben Bernanke, the Fed, former Fed chair, implemented the idea of a price objective. Prior to that, called the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 1950s, what did an investor have to go on to drive prices higher or lower? They had to decide, are prices stable? Now, if we fixate as investors on the 2% target, you could miss a great deal of return in your investment portfolio. And many that have fixated on the 2% target in the past 6 months have lost a significant amount of investment return in their portfolios because we haven't gotten to 2%, but we might be achieving price stability, which Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker defined as a level of price changes or degree of price changes that ceases to have an impact on business and household decision-making. And that's where we're moving, and that's why the equity market is feeling better, because we're getting closer to an era of price stability, even if it's not 2%.
Tony, behind closed doors, some of the conversations I have with the people I know and that I respect, we talk about that 2% inflation target, and we try to determine what it would take for the Fed to consider removing that target. Now, I know it's far-fetched, but do you feel that the Fed in this environment can even remotely consider that if inflation stays persistently high?
It's highly improbable now. They can't walk back on the notion, especially with the inflation rate higher, because then market participants would lose their sense as to where the anchor is, because it's become ingrained in thinking. But again, as investors, we have to take a step back and decide, is the inflation that we're experiencing enough to get in the way of future cash flows for businesses, to pay you back at maturity, to pay the interest on your bonds, etc.?
Give us and this goes to economics, and I want to go to your Staten Island and Richmond County. I'm sorry, but if I'm at the Fed and I'm looking at Crescenzi's Staten Island, it's a great labor picture. Overlying your brilliance in the financial space is there this huge elephant in the room, which is the labor economy of America.
The story for the 2020s, which is a lot different than the 2010s, is a story of retirements and immigration, with retirements outweighing the immigration over the longer span of time. There's a shortage of labor, and the context is this notion of stakeholder capitalism, which is different than the notion of shareholder capitalism, which Milton Friedman shepherded in the 1970s when he said the sole purpose of a company is to grow its profits. No company can say that today. They have to be seen as a partner with the community, as seen to be helping with climate change, and also contributing to a diverse and inclusive workforce. And so in that context, it's more likely that companies, given that there's labor shortages, will want to share income more. And final stat, Tom, is think 1957, the biggest birth year last century. 65 and a half years later, they're receiving Social Security and retiring. And this wave lasts until the last boomer born in 64 retires in the early 2030s. So we've got a shortage of labor that'll last a while. But final word is immigration is helping lift GDP potential.
Tony, thank you. He is with PIMCO. Tony Crescenzi.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
Books about the grabbing the coupon is really what this is about.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Daily look at the front page is a stack of newspapers at the desk of Lisa Mateo. Fired up. She's got a whole list of twisted stories here. People love this or they hate this. People are like, can you just talk about Japanese yen? And I'm like, come on. Lisa's got some jewels here. What do you start with?
All right. This one is on Bloomberg. This has been going on. The U.S. preparing for an antitrust suit against Live Nation over Ticketmaster. So this Live Nation Ticketmaster whole situation has been going on for some time. Sources are saying they want to force Live Nation to spin off the Ticketmaster ticketing business. The agency has been investigating that entertainment giant for years. So it's been going on. The reason why, well, there's concerns Live Nation illegally tied its concert promotion services to use on Ticketmaster. But these two companies emerged like 14 years ago after this lengthy antitrust investigation. They both agreed that they wouldn't tie those services together. But now they're saying, well, they
are doing
that.
I've got a really strong opinion on this, Damien, before I voice. What's your thoughts on Live Nation?
Well, when we go on tour, what does that mean for us, right? We're not going to be really reaching our true audience out there. You on guitar, me on the bongos. So, I mean, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Here's my thoughts on this. This is all about the artists. The artists want to feel that they're being an egalitarian, and I'm going to have a $80 or $100 ticket so the people can come see me. And the demand for some of these acts is not $80 or $100. It's way, way higher. It's just an artificial auction theory because the demand is way, way higher to see Pick the Artist, but the artist doesn't want to visibly show on Ticketmaster a $480 ticket.
Getting tickets for U2 at the Sphere or Billy Joel here at MSG. Yeah. I mean, there you go.
The Taylor Swift tickets. Swifties.
I take this back to the artists. I take it right back, and they're representatives, you know, they're artists. And it's a mess. I mean, and there, what's there going to be? Litigation out of this lease? Is that the basic
idea? That's what they're trying. Antitrust suit. Yeah.
Okay. What do you got
next? We'll see. Bubble tea. Have you ever tried it? Either of you?
Oh, God.
No. The milky beverage with the tapioca bubbles in it? No. I haven't tried it. The kids love it.
Oh, really?
My Apple Pay goes. I don't even know how much I spent on this for my daughter. But here's the thing. So the market for it in China, competitive. They're fighting for customers. But now they want to start to bring them, you know, here to the mainland, to different areas. You have a company like Cha Panda. They're looking at Southeast Asia. They're looking at opening a store in South Korea a few years ago. You have Hey Tea. They opened up in New York in December. So they're starting to trickle in. A few companies planning IPOs in the coming months in Hong Kong. But they're saying that they're going to start rivaling coffee chains, that it's going to be this battle between the coffee chains and the bubble tea.
My bank does like, what did you spend during the year? You get it about now, you know, for 2020. Bubble tea was number 8 on my list.
I'm telling you.
I don't even know this. I mean, the fights block to block on the Upper East Side on bubble tea. Have you ever had it?
I've tried it. It's too sweet for me. I can't do it.
It's basically sugar and tea, right?
Yes. Am I and milk.
Narrowing it down. And this is cherubs out the door. It's
long
3 p.m.
Lines. Yes.
Long lines.
Yes. And they're addicted. They're in the malls. They're overtaking. Like, they're just going to the
Where's Starbucks on this?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. They're going to start rivaling in with the coffee chain. So
okay.
We'll see how this battle goes. Bubble I don't know. Tea. Do New Yorkers like their bubble tea or their coffee? That's the question.
Or their strawberry lemon refreshers.
The cherubs like their bubble tea. Let's move on. This is too painful.
It is. Okay, here's a new trend for you. Longevity vacations.
Yes.
Okay, this is the trend. People are dishing out big money. We're talking about $1,200 to go on vacation and get ozone therapy or to $1,800 to get early detection cancer tests on their vacation.
Wow.
And it's really, really going on. Resorts are starting to go to it. Resorts can now find biological age testing, poolside vitamin IV drips, Stelsem therapy. This is all happening for
this
a big
This is so
price.
Damien Sassauer.
I mean, shout out to Dan Weinstein, Restore Hyper Wellness. IV drips on vacation. You don't have to go to vacation to get your IV drip. You could do it right in Westchester County. Restore Hyper Wellness, Dan Weinstein, shout out.
Is there such a thing as a Tang drip?
Tang drip? You need one of those.
Okay, but this is the...
No, in all seriousness.
I don't have the guy in front. Yeah, in all seriousness, there's a lot of people with a lot of disposable income into this.
Taking red light, they do cryo there, you go into this freezing chamber. I've not done any of this, by the way.
Bloomberg Intelligence has a cryo thing.
It puts years on your life.
Gina Martin Adams is in there 3 days a week.
Which...
Are you done or is that
No,
it?
This last one's a zinger. Gonna love this one.
Oh, thank you. More bubble tea.
Can't wait.
This is from the New York Post. So apparently there was this blog post on X from a tech executive who's saying he spoke to a guy who admitted to spending $10,000 a month on AI girlfriends.
Oh.
Okay, so he went on different websites. He create them. He points to two ones, Candy AI and Cupid AI. So this tech guy is saying that if someone were to come up with a dating app that was for digital AI girlfriends, they could make $1 billion.
I have two daughters, Lisa. I can't talk about AI girlfriends.
I don't believe this.
It's terrible.
I don't know where this is going.
Can
I mean,
to
Lisa's...
Wives on Saturday night, the AI girlfriends on Friday night. We get it.
Damien, help me here. I get, this is like a Mandeep Singh thing. I get AI for ChatGPT, and the computer people tell me it's like a whole new world after all.
Yeah.
But other than that, aren't we just searching around for things that maybe will stick to the wall?
You know, I have to say, I mean, there was a big take on the terminal. I don't know if you caught it, Lisa, Tom, about sextortion scams and driving teenage. I don't want to get all dour here, but it's a real serious thing. And you got to read this article. It's about driving teenage boys to suicide. I mean, Nigeria, like these guys are basically pretending to be girls, reaching out to young students, high school students and causing them to do some really awful things. It's really terrible. Anyway, got to read it. It's a big take on Bloomberg. It's on top.
Okay. There's the newspapers today. Sort of, that was a different one. I mean,
AI girlfriends.
Well, I'm worried more about bubble tea. That's more the reality. All I know is Lisa Mateo drove the market higher with our newspapers.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.